Okay, this is an oral interview with Terrell Williams, former chairman of the SEC. Asking questions are Dan Gelder and Amy Goodman. It's January 19th, 2006. Why don't we start, Harold, if you could talk a little bit about your background before you came to the SEC.
Well, my I guess a relevant background. Since beginning when I was 10 years old, my father was an accountant. And I started working on accounting matters, originally just adding, using the adding machine. But I was, when I was that age, and worked with him doing tax returns and all kinds of basic accounting matters all the way through my schooling. And indeed, I worked my way through Harvard Law School doing accounting, particularly during tax season. My law practice began with a small firm in Los Angeles doing corporate and tax work, actually with a specialty initially in criminal tax fraud cases, interrupted by the Korean War. Came back to the firm and then joined what in effect was Norton Simons Organization in 1956. I started off as associate tax counsel, went from there to tax counsel, to VP finance, to executive vice president, to president and chairman of the board over a period of, I guess, 15 years. During the course of that, I was involved very closely in the financial statements and the accounting of the company, and all kinds of disclosure issues. I was invited down to the commission at one time because I, in effect, inadvertently created a holding company that we weren't aware of. At the same time, I then went on from private practice. I sort of climbed the mountain in private practice, and in 1968, started looking for something else to do when I became chairman of the board. Decided I didn't want to run another company after I made tomato sauce. It's not much of a promotion like dog food, which I was invited to do by another stock exchange company. Decided I really wanted to do something else. It was 2 years later that I was invited to become dean of the graduate school, later called the graduate school of management at UCLA. And both when I was with the company, which originally was called Hunt Foods, became Hunt Foods and Industries, and then Norton Simon Incorporated. And while I was at, and also I should think that the organization was, the company was acquisitive. We made a number of acquisitions, which usually began with the purchase of a block of stock in an unfriendly situation. And I was often the representative to the, and after insisting that board representation, I was the one who went in there. My first exposure to corporate boards, other than our own, and dissatisfaction with the insular quality and the parochialism of corporate boards. And of course, over the years, including when I was in, at UCLA, I was on a number of boards. And I might also be back in with the company. We were one of the original accounting bulletin that dealt with poolings versus purchase. I think we were the first poolings at that time. So I go back quite a ways and worked closely with passengers, sales, or our auditors. So I had an in-depth awareness of accounting issues, had a lot of perspective on corporate boards, and I also had the opportunity to manage an investment portfolio with the company. So I dealt with stock offerings. I was president of an investment company, which was part of the overall organization. Was one of my close friends, and since one of my mentors was Gus Levy of Goldman Sachs. And he sort of adopted me. In fact, probably 3 days out of five, I get a phone call early in the morning from Gus saying, "What's new, kid?" And it became quite a relationship. It meant a lot to me. At UCLA, I talked a lot about social responsibility business, the roles of boards of directors and management, and which in a sense led up to maybe in some ways my role as a commission. I was, when those petroleum ran into problems, and were actually sued by the Center for Law and Public Interest and agreed to the presence of some new disinterested directors. I was one of three who went in. Maybe through some of that background and exposure, I got a call, and it was from Stanley one day, Stanley Sporkin, asking if I would go into Board of Lockheed and serve a similar situation, which I declined to do because I just had too much on my plate.
What year would that have been?
That would have been around 1975, 76, about a year or two before I came on.
And then didn't you also serve on the Commission's Advisory Committee on Disclosure?
I'd run into Al Summers at some meeting or other, shortly before he was formally the commissioner. We chatted, and then he invited me to come on that committee, which I enjoyed, which gave me, another kind of preparation for the being chairman, because we did talk extensively about the integration of 33 and 34 acts, some of the problems related there, too, and exposed me to a number of people of the staff of the commission. Vicki Beach particularly, I think Vic Rowe got involved to some extent at that time. And I guess that led then next to, as a logical progression, to a call one day from, I can't remember his first name, his last name was Bowles, and he was from the Connecticut Bowles, who somehow was involved with the search for a chair of the commission. And I never was clear just exactly where he fit, but obviously he did. And we had a chat, and he came out and visited me. We had another chat. And then I went to New York and met some people on Wall Street. We had a meeting hosted by Neil Batten, who was chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. And then I think a lengthy phone call with a staffer who was working at the White House, and then an invitation to. Oh, and also Rod Hills, who I'd known for years before he became chairman, he put in a good word for me, and next thing I knew, I was meeting with President Carter.
But this would have been just shortly after President Carter was elected.
Right, he was already in office.
Had you been involved in the campaign or in politics? Was that an aspect of it?
President, my first campaign was for Harry Truman. I was not of age. But I was concerned enough about that election that I actually was walking the Bronx, talking to housewives in Yiddish about why they should vote for Harry Truman. The first campaign that I had nothing to do with was Jimmy Carter. I didn't work for him. I didn't support him. Nothing negative about it, but I just didn't feel any particular kinship. Of course, that changed, obviously. I think he's been a wonderful ex-president, particularly.
Do you recall what he asked you about during your interview?
It was fairly lengthy. It was just chatted generally. I don't remember the content of it. I did talk about needing more resources, and his answer, in effect, was, you've got to do the best you can with what you got. Which was pretty straightforward. The only commitment he asked of me is that I serve a full 5 years as chairman, which I agreed to do. In fact,
you should have asked him for a commitment to serve at least 5 years.
That's right. In fact, it's really fortuitous because if he had been reelected, I would not have been available for the Getty, which was obviously an exciting part of my life. But actually, this was a slam dunk kind of commitment. I mean, the typical chairman up to that time had served a little over 2 years. I would have been totally uninterested in a 2-year term because the SEC was not a stepping stone for me. It wasn't recess, and unless I could be there long enough to possibly have some impact, I would not have been interested in doing it. This was a change of direction in my life, not the first time, nor the last time, but it was an interesting challenge for me. I cared about the issues given a lot of my background. It was a credible agency I would have been proud to be identified with, and it was just an unusual opportunity. So where do we go from here?
Do you recall what your confirmation hearings were like?
It was a love fest. Proxmire was fine. I don't even remember specifically what he asked me. I think if it had been challenging, I'd remember it. It was really a very, I'd met with him privately before, but it was simple. It was clean. It was totally non-contentious.
What, and a number of other people served on the commission while you were there. Phil Loomis, John Evans, Irv Pollock, Roberta Carmel, Steve Friedman, Barbara Thomas. I think that covers them.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, what was your relationship like with the other commissioners?
I thought it was good with all of them. I guess I was closer to some than others. I think I felt closer to Irv and probably to Steve than I did to some of the others. I liked them all. Roberta could be a little difficult at times. I remember when I gave my first SEC talk here at the Securities Institute, as you know, at the time, that was very critical of boards of directors. She labeled it as polemic, which I didn't appreciate. But I think we had a good relationship. I had a good relationship with John Evans, and you know, there were issues we really disagreed on. This whole market reg and Rule 390, we had some basic disagreements on it. I didn't want to move as rapidly or in the direction that both Irv and Evans would have preferred. But I think we were very collegial. We worked together, and I think it was one of our strengths. It made it a very enjoyable experience, obviously. But I don't know whether what made for that congeniality as compared to some of the other, like the recent commission. But I found it just a very, very congenial working relationship.
Which is kind of a footnote to that. Were you consulted by the White House at all in terms of the people that were appointed to the commission or reappointed after you were there, or did they pretty much do that without your...
No, part of my understanding with the president was that I would have input. And as it evolved, when we had the first vacancy, the one that Roberta filled, the White House made it clear they wanted a woman. But I surfaced to women. The same thing with Margaret Thomas. With Steve, I just recommended Steve and they went along with him. So I had a good working relationship with the White House on succession. What was interesting, though, is the relationship with the White House, this is probably an oversimplification, but there seems to be a fundamental difference between the attitude of Democratic presidents and Republican presidents in terms of the relationship between the chair of the commission and the White House. Once I was appointed and confirmed, I had really very limited contact with the White House.
I don't know about you, Dan, but that was one of the things that surprised me working in your office was how there was, I think at one point I got invited over to the White House because they wanted all the women in the administration to show up for something. But other than that, I don't think there was any, I don't recall much, if any, contact between our office and the administration.
No, I heard this story from Mill Batten because obviously if he was in a position to interview me, he had some relationship with the White House. But Mill went to the White House at one point and complained about me and what I was doing. And the president told him to talk to me because I was an independent agency. The one call I got was from Jim Schlesinger one day because Anand Khashoggi was coming in, wanted to come into the United States on some energy matters, and we were after him. And Jim asked me if we would stand back. And my inclination was not to, but I thought I wouldn't take it on myself. We had an emergency meeting with the commission. And the conclusion was, no, we won't stand back. Now, there were two times that I did talk to the White House staff. One time when the Tax Reform Act came up, I don't know what year that was. It was early on, 79, somewhere around in there. And the Senate witness list came out. Blumenthal was the lead-off witness in opposition to the tax change. I was the lead-off witness in support of the tax change. Stu Eisenstadt invited me to lunch at the White House. And he spent the whole lunch telling me why the administration was opposed to the act. And we got to dessert. I turned to look at Stu and I said, Stu, do you have any interest in knowing why I'm in favor of it? It was a beautiful example of the insularity that happens in the White House. It wasn't peculiar to the Clinton administration. It was true. I had some exposure to both the Nixon and Johnson administration. It was true there as well. The other time, it was similar. I think the issue was the senior executive service when that was coming in or something. And I had some concerns about the effect of it. I think that's what it was. All I know is, I met with the staff. And they started off telling me why I didn't have a problem. And I listened to it and I said, "What? Tell me you don't give a shit about my problem, but don't tell me I don't have a problem." That was the extent of my exposure to the White House. Now, I met periodically with Mike Blumenthal, who I'd known before.
He was the Treasury
Secretary. And then I did have some dealings with with Bob Mundheim, who was General Counsel, who again I'd known for years before then, and Bob Carswell. I did have some dealings with Carswell on the Silver Scandal. We worked together on that, along with Paul Volcker at the Fed. And actually, through that episode, Paul and I became quite good friends, which we still are. So I would meet with him occasionally, we'd talk about things, but it was more just general conversation rather than anything in particular.
Let's turn to the FCC staff. Your annual report, Transmittal Letters, which were terrific in terms of historical interest in giving an overview of what was going on at the Commission during your years, but you consistently praised the quality and dedication of the FCC staff. What was your relationship with the staff members, both the people who had been there for a long time and the people that you brought in?
Well, again, I think it was similar to my relationship with the commissioners. My view is that it was a very young, healthy, positive relationship. Now, again, there were some issues we didn't agree on, and maybe the most dramatic, again, was Margaret Ragg. Lee Picard and I just didn't get along in terms of philosophy and where I wanted to go. And Andy Klein wasn't always happy with where I wanted to go. But I think it was respectful and right across the board. Stanley was always a bit of a concern. I admire him, and we have very affectionate regard for him. And he did wonderful work for the agency and for the securities industry. There were times when I did get a little concerned about, I guess, pushing the boundaries. But again, I thought that was... He and I had one showdown in the privacy of my office one day. I'll give you details, but it was a consequence of it. We had turned him down at a commission meeting on something. And when we were through with that, he slammed his papers down on the desk and said, "This is a miscarriage of justice." So I invited him into my office. We had a private discussion.
Well, how would you say your relationship with the staff differed in terms of other organizations? You've come into various other organizations in your career and kind of acquired a staff. How would you say the situation at the commission compared to those experiences?
Well, when I was at the university, I've been there for not very long, when I realized that probably with tenure as it is, the only person I could fire there was me. So you learn to function in ways that are collegial. And you function by getting people on board, by persuasion, by talking things through with their elements of disagreement. And I think that served me a good stead. And that's been my management style basically ever since, even with the Getty, where I could have fired anybody. It's just a different... I'm not autocratic in my management style, and I think that goes a long way towards building rapport. At least that's my perception. I've got to ask the staff how they perceive it.
Well, one thing you did, at least is memorable to me, and I think was different than both your predecessor and your successor, is you have retreats from time to time. I remember we'd meet at your house occasionally. I think I remember Stanley donning a swimming suit and swimming in the lap pool while the rest of us watched. And I remember going to Grossinger's. I think that was right at the time that Carter was defeated for real.
That's right.
And what, is that something that you've done in other organizations?
Yeah, it's something I did at the company and at the university. It's just an opportunity. It has two purposes. One, to pull back from the day-to-day and try to think more in a more macro sense or more broadly about where we are and where we need to go. And also for collegiality. On a day-to-day basis, it cannot be terribly collegial for the office. You're welcome. Everybody's got their own thing to do. And this was just an effort because there had to be overlap between many of the activities. And the collegiality at the top level could to some extent at least be reflected down through the organization. So it's something that I've done extensively before and since.
One of the things you mentioned was talking to the president about the need for more resources at the SEC. And as you know, in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, Congress finally gave the SEC probably more than it's ever gotten at once before. What do you think, if you had had more resources available to you at the commission, how do you think you might have used them?
It's hard for me to put myself back to that extent, but one thing that I felt at the commission, by contrast to almost any place else I did, and that is the absence of any what I call discretionary funds. The funds that one could use to explore or to try things. And I think if you know, what I can't separate too is what I would have done more of versus had I been there longer versus if my successor had pursued the same course. I mean, they're all sort of parts of the same thing. I think of the accounting profession, for example. I think with more resources, I think we might have been, with the hindsight, we should have been more aggressive in following up on their own self-regulatory activities. I have met with the profession and pushed them and urged them, but I concluded that with the benefit of hindsight, I think I would have still done the same thing. To let them go, in a sense, the way they wanted to go in terms of self-regulation. I told them I thought it wouldn't work. I regret that my successor didn't pursue it because I think maybe we could have handed off some problems that surfaced in the course of the exhaustion. But I think if I had more resources, I would have pushed harder on that. I think I probably would have done more in the economics area, because the issue, for example, of compensation, I pushed it some, but then I sort of pulled back on it because we really didn't have at that point a kind of economic approaches that would have enabled us to quantify some things that now we're going about quantifying. I think we certainly could have used more resources in investment management, which I think anyway was always sort of not a stepchild, but I don't think we had the resources to do the oversight that they needed to do. And you may remember that it was my practice to, when we went to Congress, I remember saying it in one session, given the budget as recommended by OMB, I'll tell you some of the things we're not going to do that we're charged by law to do. Congress didn't want to hear that. I mean, I call it backing the wagon up. I think it's a responsibility of the agency to do that. I wish I could look back at that. I tell you, if I look at that, I could tell you more about what I would have wanted to do with the resources. I don't remember it.
Well, just going back to the economics side of it for a minute, did you feel that there was a resistance to bringing economic analysis into the decision making? The agency was pretty heavily lawyered rather than the...
Yeah, I think there's a lack of appreciation for the value of it. And I'm not sure we have the greatest advocates for it. To be candid, there were a couple of people I tried to get to come down But the young professor at Harvard, who's now one of the top people, I really tried desperately, he has come down for a couple of years, but he wouldn't do it. I think the talent we had was okay, but they didn't do the missionary work that would have helped a lot.
Let's turn to what's perhaps your favorite topic and my favorite topic, and maybe Dan's, I don't know.
It's
corporate governance. Many of the speeches that you devoted a lot of your speeches and public statements to corporate governance issues and the need for more independent directors. You touched on it a little, but maybe you could talk a little bit more about your interest in that subject and why you felt it was important at the commission to make those kinds of statements.
Yeah, well, one thing I did that may be unusual for chairman, I recognized by instinct, because I give a lot of speeches before I came to the commission, the value of the bully pulpit, which I'm not sure chairman generally have appreciated. And the premise that underlay most of what I had to say was, and in much of my conduct at the commission, is I am really a great believer in the capitalist system and the importance of the private sector, how it functions, the responsibility with which it functions, and the concern that if it doesn't function responsibly, whatever that means, that the answer will be government regulation. And while I'm not anti-regulation per se by a long shot, I think you can't effectively regulate conduct but efforts are made to do it. And I think it can hamper and even destroy the vitality of capitalism in the private sector. And so basically my thing was, recall, as you in effect felt a sense of, like, you don't get on the ball and think you're going to have the government will clean it up for you. And I think Sarbanes-Oxley is a good piece of legislation. I guess it's my impression for a few relationships I really maintained in the congressional after I left the commission was with Paul Sarbanes. And who I saw several times in LA and in Washington. And Paul called me and asked me to spend a little time with the staff on the Sarbanes-Oxley, so I had a minor bit of input into it. I ramble around a little. If I had tried, or the commission had tried, to overrule the accounting profession on their own self-regulatory efforts when I was there, it would have been viewed as the heavy hand of government. When it came to Sarbanes-Oxley, they'd done it to themselves. There's a whole difference. But I wish they'd listened, because if they had, they wouldn't have had to have Sarbanes-Oxley. But they remind me of all kinds of things. I'll get back to your question. When I was at the commission, Arthur Andersen already had more than half of their revenues from consulting. And that consulting side was more profitable than the audit side. And this was to me was a warning of things to come. That's why we put in the requirement of disclosing all audit fees.
Right, ASR 250, right.
Right, which John Shad proceeded to take out.
Right, that was his first act as chairman, actually.
That was before he appointed you.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, so getting back to the director's thing, it really was a fundamental belief in my part that if the private sector is to function, you know, Adolf Berle back in the 30s put it very well. He talked about power without property. Because the whole structure of the discipline of the private sector had changed. You didn't have owners running the business or holding management accountable. And you had this diffusion of ownership among shareholders of the Wall Street pool and so forth. And somehow, somebody has to hold management accountable. And boards of directors have become many societies, and nobody wants to be the skunk at the picnic. So they really weren't doing their job. They were much too collegial and friendly and appointed by the CEO. Like, I still cringe when they talk about management slate of directors. It's conceptually, it's a total misnomer. So that's really what was pushing me on boards of directors and audit committees and committees and so forth.
But do you think it had an impact, or do you think it's more of a situation where the kinds of warnings you were giving, the use you were making as a board public, wasn't heeded by the business community?
Oh, I think it wasn't heeded. I'd like to think it had some impact, but I couldn't prove it. And certainly it took a long while before. But over the years, there was an evolution towards more and more, at least outside directors, some more independent than others. So I'd like to think that maybe I boosted the process a bit, but things made a dramatic change. No, I don't think I have. I know this, that when I came back out of the commission, none of the boards I'd been on before I went to the commission invited me back.
Were you concerned about the commission's lack of perceived authority in the governance area? I know we put forth several disclosure rules, getting more information about boards and board committees. But did you feel frustrated by the commission's lack of authority in this area?
Yeah, somewhat. I think we could have done more in disclosure. We could have pushed that envelope further, or certainly my successor could have. But the thing is, the commission didn't keep that ball rolling at all. The successors didn't. But again, it goes to, you have turnover. The chairman has his own ideas about what's important and what his philosophy is. But I would have liked to see that push through. There's one thing that did happen. Senator Metzenbaum introduced something that he called the Shareholders' Rights Act. And I went in and testified against it. And after the session, Howard said to me, "How can you testify against it? This is all you're talking about." I said, "Yeah, it's all I'm talking about. I worked on it."
So there was some legislation that was enacted during your tenure.
In terms of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The FCPA would have been enacted, I guess, fairly soon after you arrived.
Right.
Were you involved in urging Congress to enact the FCPA, and how did the existence of the statute affect your agenda?
I don't think I had any effect on it. I think I did speak and testify in favor of it, but the ball was pretty well rolling by the time I got there, so I don't think I had any significant impact, if any, on the legislation. Obviously, in terms of resources and in terms of the focus of enforcement, it was a major factor. We spent a lot of time on it, and really, in turn, I think it led to a couple of things. As I remember it, one is, both were in fact, two things that followed from that, that have come thrust. One, it was the question of the extent to which we would push the envelope, and in a sense test the boundaries or make laws to enforce the actions. And I got uncomfortable with that area, and that's when we established the policy group, or whatever it was called, within the General Counsel's
Council group.
I really wanted a sense of independent of enforcement of how does this proposed action fit? What does it really do? It was a more general value, but enforcement, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was a good piece of that, as I recall. And the other was the talk I gave just before I left the commission, which kind of articulated at least what I saw as the parameters of the act. What fascinated me, I joined SCAD and ARPS after I left the Getty. This was 1998. And the first matter I got involved with there was Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And what did they pull out? The speech. I don't believe this. And interestingly, we have a matter now going with a firm in the Midwest, and we had their partners out actually earlier this week. And one of them says, just use my speech because they had a matter for the commission on the program. That's my longevity. That's my point.
Well, then I have to end, and I mentioned to Herb Wander yesterday that we were going to be having this interview today. As you probably know, Herb is chairing the Small Business Advisory Committee that the Commission has set up recently, and one of the things they're most concerned about is internal control reporting and Section 404 summary docs that should be interpreted. When I said I was going to be seeing you, Herb said, oh, he's my hero. I just read his speech on interpretation of the Accounting Convention of the FCPA, and I think there's a lot in there that we ought to be using today.
In fact, at the last session that Dan just spoke on, one of the points that people made was that people talk about 404 as if it was brand new,
yeah.
but the part of 404 dealing with the maintenance of internal controls goes back to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
I guess maybe with that lead-in, we should ask you what your perspective is about the controversy in that area today. I mean, there's a lot of...
On 404?
On 404, a lot of back and forth about whether it's worth the cost or whether it's beneficial.
Well, it's beneficial. I don't know that it's worth the cost if you look at it that way, other than to say that I think a lot of the cost isn't necessarily self-imposed.
By companies or the accounting firms?
By
the auditors.
Yeah. And secondly, I think there's a lot of deferred maintenance here. So the cost should come down as people get more comfortable with it, as a lot of deferred maintenance is out of the way. But I think 404 is great.
Let's turn to the corporate disclosure area. You mentioned that you were on the advisory committee on corporate disclosure. How did that impact your views of what the commission should do in the disclosure area?
Well, it had a major impact. And candidly, the perspective I got from that advisory committee was one I didn't have at all. Yeah, I hadn't focused on what was in the 33 Act or 34 Act or the relationship of the two, but the advisory committee really sort of oriented me to a lot of the issues and encouraged me to support the push in that area. Now, candidly, I don't remember precisely what we did, but I still think of the admonition that Susan Douglas had given when he left the SEC, when he said the one thing I didn't accomplish was the integration of the two. I figured we might as well be the ones to claim we did it.
Do you recall any impediments to the integration? To the integration of the two statutes?
I
recall, and Dan, maybe you do a little. I remember you saying that was too bad we couldn't do something about the liability provision. And I think it's very interesting because the commission, just having done Securities Act reform, much of the discussion today about whether people will or will not use some of the freedoms that the SEC has given relates back to liability concerns.
Yes.
It is. If you look through the annual report transmittal letters that Amy mentioned earlier, integration is really one of the central things that's featured in those letters of commission accomplishment during the years that you were chairman. But perhaps it wasn't really a policy issue any longer.
That was
really
a matter of implementation. It didn't take much of my time or attention at that point, other than when the proposed rule change or whatever came in.
But there was clear direction to the staff to go do this.
Yeah.
How about, were there concerns during your time at the commission about the impact of the commission's rules on small business?
I don't call it specific, but...
Yeah, I mean, again, that's a theme that comes through from the letters, but I'm not sure that I remember specific initiative.
Yeah, I don't remember. We talked about that. I don't recall anything specific.
And we've already touched a little on your relations with the Enforcement Division and Stan Spork and that. Anything else that stands out in your memory in terms of the Commission's enforcement work during those years?
No,
that's what
I can think of.
Let's turn back to the accounting profession. We talked a little bit about self-regulation. Do you recall in the accounting area, as opposed to the regulation of the profession area, some of the issues that the commission had to deal with, such as oil and gas accounting or TUI disciplinary proceedings?
Well, in oil and gas, we did something the commission doesn't do very often, but as we in effect took it away from the profession and established our own rules at full cost. The profession wasn't very happy about it, just in principle because of this position. I was very concerned about inflation and inflation accounting. I remember we got some supplemental disclosure in that area.
Do you recall what your relationship was like with the FASB during this period?
I know I met with the leadership fairly often. I don't recall anything specific, other than in oil and gas, where as I said, we sort of preempted the matter.
I mean, you made some comments earlier to suggest that the relationship between the commission and the accounting profession was, I don't know, was difficult in those years of sort of, I don't know, arm's length. But it seems to me that from a certain perspective, the establishment of the POB and the peer review process was really a major triumph at that time. It may not have ultimately worked out, but it took the profession certainly a step beyond where it was when you came into it.
That's very true, but it was a defensive step, and it was kind of a minimal step that I really thought would not. You know, they had so many qualifications on it, you couldn't look at certain lines, and it was doomed to fail. But for me to sit there and say this is going to fail, we're going to tell you how to do it, we're going to preempt it. I just didn't feel it was the appropriate role for the commission at that point. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe we should have done it. But as I said earlier, I think we would have been viewed as the heavy hand of government. And I don't know, given the, back to your question again of resources, I don't know that we would have had the capability to pursue it in terms of just as a resource matter.
You had a fairly small office at the chief accountant, as I recall, during that time.
A lot of talent, but very small office. You know, I hear today that there are 50 people in the office of chief accountant. 50 accountants, that is.
Right.
Yeah.
And how many at the PCAOB, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, anyway, I suppose similar resources would have had to have been devoted to the project if there was going to be directly a commission. But it did. The peer review system lasted, 25 years.
It shouldn't have lasted. Yeah.
I guess that was going to be my question. Were you surprised that it lasted as long as it did before there was major action?
Well, my successors didn't pursue it. And it sort of lingered there. I mean, they were on their own. Nobody was bothering them. And they waited for the big disaster to happen. I'm surprised it took so long for it to happen. Well, what's interesting, too, in terms of Sarbanes-Oxley, you probably know this anyway, but after Enron, the drafting of Sarbanes-Oxley, the sense on the Hill was Sarbanes-Oxley was dead. It took a roll call to three out of that. So if we hadn't had two disasters back-to-back, we might not have Sarbanes-Oxley.
Right, so the SEC was already, I think, post-Enron on its way to kind of trying to deal with regulation of the accounting profession.
But whether they would have gotten, how far they would have gotten in terms of, and I guess I, I didn't get to the question of whether how far is the SEC's authority to take it in that area, or whether we would have to go in for some kind of legislation. I did tell the profession when I met with them that if they developed a self-regulatory program that I really had confidence in, I was prepared to try to go to Congress, see if I could get some limitation of liability, but I didn't know how to get it. But I said, with this plan, I just, no way, I wouldn't even try it.
And they wouldn't take you up on it, even with the promise of...
They might have worried I couldn't deliver. You thought maybe I couldn't, I don't know.
And you mentioned also already the ASR 250 and the disclosure of non-audit services that the auditor was providing to audit clients. Do you think if that requirement had survived, it would have headed off any of the profession's difficulties?
It's hard to say. It's similar to this current, we're going to have a whole new approach to compensation. Will it have an effect on the level of compensation? I don't know. My hope at the time was that, again, it's the whole principle of commissioner disclosure. The hope being that disclosure would, over time, would cause some concerns. I mean, it's sort of obvious if you're getting more and more of your revenues out of consulting, you are out of accounting. There's a conflict there. Something's out of whack.
Were you concerned on an individual company by company basis as opposed to the accounting firm as a whole getting more of its revenues from a consulting versus auditing?
I was concerned about both. I was concerned that an individual company, it might compromise the audit. I was concerned in the overall that the profession itself, directly and indirectly, would move to pushing audit, non-audit services because they're getting more of their revenue off them. And I know when I went back, when I left the commission and had to get about the support board, it was clear there were loss leaders all over the place.
The audits were.
The audit side was being used as a loss leader to get into consulting work. And I think that would have surfaced over time with disclosure requirement that had really been enforced.
And today, do you see a shift in that focus?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah. Not only corporate boards at this point, but my sense is, yeah, definitely.
Issues surrounding the structure of the securities market were very hot in the agency work. The implementation of the national market system under the 1975 amendments, and then the rise of the options markets seemed to me to become the two big issues in those days. Had you come to the commission with any particular interest in the structure of the trading market?
No, not particularly. I just sort of accepted the markets as they were. I was pretty familiar with the markets, but hadn't thought about structure at all.
You were much wearier, I think, than some were about, for example, removing the offshore trading rules and opening the American Stock Exchange up
yeah.
for more competition from other markets. So, kind of what led to your concerns in that regard?
Well, I guess maybe it's a patriotic level, or a philosophical level. I thought I started with the premise that the most respected markets in the world, that the pricing mechanism seems to be working pretty effectively. I was familiar with the workings of the New York Stock Exchange, and was similar in many ways to the situation in London. It was a small enough club that dealt with each other daily, and you really don't. In my judgment, a kind of self-disciplining mechanism, along with being an effective pricing tool. But you didn't try to screw the person you're going to be dealing with the next day. It was a face-to-face kind of thing. I didn't feel that. I worried about fragmentation. I worried that at that time we were more infatuated with the potential of electronics than the reality of what it could deliver. I worry that we didn't have an effective surveillance mechanism of our own. And that pushing, I just didn't have confidence that the markets would function as well, let alone better, if we pushed towards a system, a national market system at that time. I just felt it was premature, at least premature, if not wrong bank entirely. That's where I was coming from.
Although, if I recall, during that period, one of the things you did was put a lot of pressure on the New York Stock Exchange and other exchanges,
yes,
to be able to handle larger volumes. And I remember them being outraged by the size of the volumes that you talked about, which today look infinitesimal. Where did that desire on your part come from in terms of pushing them to handle the larger trading volumes?
Well, it was independent of the national market system, in a way. I just saw them. You know, when I was managing a portfolio in the late 50s, early 60s, a 12 million share gain was pretty good. When I called Neil Batten and John Phelan down for a face-to-face meeting, I don't know what year it was, but it was in the context of all this discussion, I said, you guys have to be prepared to handle 100 million share days on a regular basis. I mean, that was pretty big-sized demand on them. I just worried, obviously, it turned out to be even a bigger issue than I anticipated, but I really worried that they would destroy themselves.
Well, I think it happened in Tokyo yesterday. Did you see this morning's paper? The Tokyo market had to close because they couldn't handle the volume.
Yeah, and that would really exacerbate the whole issue of the national market system. It would destroy the system that existed if they couldn't handle it efficiently and effectively, and yet handle the volume that they were faced with. And they were running behind the curve, and they had to get ahead of it. And effectively, they did. And I think they were on that trail, apart from anything that I might have said, but it was our responsibility to push them.
One of the other things you did in the market reg area was to bring about a moratorium on options trading. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, I don't remember in detail. I remember doing it. I remember being very concerned because the options were clearly out of control. And I remember, too, the conflict with CFTC and in the whole area of and naively appearing before the Agriculture Committee to advocate against, I don't remember quite how we put it, but were we going to take it over, or were we just concerned about their taking it? I don't know what it was now. But, and the vote of the members present was in our favor, so the chairman pulled out the votes of members of the committee who weren't there, and we lost. I just don't remember enough, but I was very concerned about the growth of that market and its impact on, I could appreciate the value of, again, as sort of a pricing mechanism, but and a hedging mechanism, but it seemed to be way out of control that we weren't prepared to deal with.
So I guess then the answer is you were willing as chairman to step in and say, wait a minute, let's stop things for a minute and take a look at what's going on. Do you think there are other areas where maybe the commission should have done that in more recent years?
Got to think about it.
Okay.
Well, why don't we want to touch on all the divisions. Why don't we touch on investment management? I mean, it seems to me that in those years, well, I think there was a kind of a study begun early in your tenure of investment management regulation, and then that led to an initiative to codify exemptive orders, and perhaps deregulation is the wrong word, but it's in some ways transfer more responsibility to investment company boards and away from the commission's staff, in the sense of them to approve every kind of exemption that a fund wanted to take advantage of. Like market structure, I would ask, is this something that you came to the commission with an interest in, or kind of dragged into when you got there?
No, it was not one I thought a lot about before I came to the commission, but I think part of it stemmed from from two senses. One was that that the commission just didn't the commission just didn't have enough resources, and that they were using their resources inefficiently. So part of the effort was to the codification was to get them out of doing things that they really were not the optimum use of their limited resources. A part of it too was, you can see the things throughout my time with the commission, pushing more towards self-regulation. In fact, I've reminded them several times, I've had some meetings with ICI and some of the people in recent years, and through their problem, and Paul Hager, who was the most recent president of ICI, is a good friend of mine for years, that you may remember this sometime, but I urged them to switch from being a trade association to being a self-regulatory body. And they thought about it and turned me down. I think it would have been a lot better off if they had been willing to do so. But that's a piece of what I was pushing towards. But I think it would be unfair to say that I think investment management was in a rut. And I think that was a piece of what I was about. And I thought they weren't using their resources very effectively.
That's interesting. I suppose that's one area, perhaps unlike accounting, where they're saying no has stuck, and still today there's no self-regulation
in
investment management.
I guess the next question, and this is really not an issue anymore, but at the time it was very hot, was the Federal Securities Code that Louis Moss had been working on for a very long time. And if I recall, and Dan especially, you'll probably recall, spending a lot of time on that. Do you have a personal perspective or any recollection of that project?
You know, I don't remember in any real detail at this point. I think I was more in favor of it than the staff was. I just don't recall it well enough to know whether I was totally in favor of the way it was, or whether I think I instinctively there were some areas that we could have built on, but there wasn't a mood at the commission to collaborate or to try to be a participant in the development of it. I thought that was unfortunate. Of course, I felt badly for Louis too.
And if I recall, one of the things that it did do was try to reconcile the liability provisions of the 33 and 34 Act, as we talked about a little earlier.
Well, we've talked a little about Congress, and I guess it's touched on Senator Sarbanes and Senator Proxmire. Are there any other personalities in Congress that you remember dealing with?
I guess Congressman Dingell or Senator Williams are two that I recall. And that,
I guess John Moss was.
Moss and Metcalf. See, Moss was very interested in the accounting profession, as I recall.
Well, I don't recall. I recall the only one that Dingell gave me a hard time was Moss, obviously, because he was the main proponent behind the national market system, and he wasn't very happy about the fact we weren't pushing it the way he would have liked. Other than that, I think my relationship was good. It was congenial, and
you didn't particularly face problems having to fend off political pressure,
no,
either from the White House or Congress or other sources for that.
Well, I had an episode that was a sort of a personal experience in my life that I have a clear recollection of, and I've referred to it a number of times in this. Describing who I am. I've been at the commission probably for a month, and I got a call from a congressman from Pennsylvania who complained about how constituents of his was being treated by the commission. But I don't remember whether it was enforcement or another division. And I listened. And
and took some votes on this. And then he said, well, I said, I'll look into it. He said, no, calm down and tell me what you did about it. I said, no, I won't. He said, really? I can hear from him. I said, let's have it. We run an independent agency. We have a complaint. I'm bound to pursue it. But I will not report back to you what I found. And he yelled at me and hung up. Like, I don't know how many times in my life this happened, but I know I was sitting there. And I said to myself out loud, I said, Harold, have you ever had any question about who you are? You're going to find out in this job. apart from the episodes I've mentioned, I didn't feel any pressure, untoward pressure from the Hill. I was testifying before Congress one day, and I didn't know what the issue was. But there was a congressman at the far end, on the left-hand side, a red-headed young guy, who took me on. And he was good. He really took me over the course. I didn't know what the issue was. But he became a good friend. It was Kavanaugh from Nebraska. Yeah. You might have been there at the time. I just don't know what the issue was.
Yeah, I can't remember Congressman Kavanaugh, now that you mention it. I guess I've forgotten specifically.
Still exchange Christmas cards. But other than that, the relationship with Congress was fine. They respected the agency, as did the White House.
How about your relationship with the press?
The Fourth Estate.
Well, of course, you know, that was Judy Miller's first.
Right, we all had a good recollection of that.
I don't suppose you stayed in touch with
No. It's interesting. I was not terribly comfortable with her when she was covering the commission. I don't remember why, but I remember instinctively I wasn't. Not because she was a woman either. And then there was a reporter from the Post who was a regular, John. I remember his last name. Snow sticks in my mind. I don't think that's right. It was a short name. I thought my relationship with the press was good, but I remember this Post reporter. He interviewed me, and I'd been there several years, and he said something about happiness of the commission or something. And my response was something about, well, this is not Happinessville, we're here to do a job, or something of the sort. And when he closed his briefcase, he said to me, if you were a typical chairman, your staff would be planning your going away party instead of complaining about you. And a couple of days later, I was shaving, and my wife walked in, the look on her face, and page one of the Washington Post on happiness at the SEC. But other than that, I don't think there was. There was an episode with. Again, I don't remember what the issue was, but there was a writing column in the Wall Street Journal about me and the commission, and about me really. And somehow I'd gotten wind of the fact that he'd gone to lengths to find out what I paid for our house in Georgetown. And that was going to be in the article. I don't remember how I found out who your husband was. And I called him and said, look, I respect you, write what you want and all, but there's something I think that I'm rather personal and sensitive that I don't think are germane to what you're going to write. And I'd appreciate it if you could leave it out. Well, he didn't leave it out. He just told me to go shut it. Those are the only two instances where I would think of it. But other than that, I thought the press treatment was basically fair. I think the relationships were pretty good. I wasn't seeking the press. It was not my style to look for coverage, but to try to be open and responsive when one asks.
Did you have any concerns? I know some other chairmen have over the years of the staff talking to the press.
Oh, sure, I had concerns about that. And I'm sure they were talking to the press. That's where the unhappiness of the commission comes from, as one example of it. But they were, there were leaks coming out of the commission. But there's not much one can do about that. That was more than one I could have traced back to, but it was probably my point.
Well, we've probably touched on all of the substantive areas we wanted to, but I think it's sort of the nature of these oral histories to try and capture anecdotes and colorful people. I mean, are there any events you would remember from those days that we haven't talked about, or any people that were particularly influential or interesting?
As far as events, and you know better than I whether this made a difference, but I think it did. The silly little things that at the time don't seem that have been important at any point, but turn out to little expenditures on stage, but happen. I'd been there, I don't know, several weeks. We were in a commission meeting. I hadn't been there very long, the second week or whatever. And I don't remember what the case was or what the memo was, but I think one of the commissioners asked a question that came up, and I said, well, the answer is in this footnote on page 52. And next thing I knew, that was all over the commission.
Well, it meant something to the staff if they knew that the commissioner, that you were actually reading the memo.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, which didn't always occur.
Right, yeah, I thought that was it's the kind of thing that establishes a reputation for you in a sense that the commission, but topic's not something I intended, but it just happened and it was a very positive development.
In that vein, do you think your background as a lawyer kind of helped establish your rapport with the staff?
Oh, I would think so. Yeah. In terms of personalities, right? I don't think of any other anecdotes. I'll think about it. But in terms of personalities, of course, one personality that was around the commission was Sandy Gillis.
Sure.
In the whole market area. I think he did some good staff work for me, but at least raised some issues for me to arrive at a judgment about.
Well, I've forgotten about Sandy. I said, what was your background with him? How did he come to be involved in advising on market structures?
I didn't have any background with Sandy. I'd known his father, Cy Lewis at Bear Stearns, but it was shortly after I came to the commission. I don't know where I was. I was giving a talk someplace or something like that. And he came up to me and started talking to me about the markets and his concerns about it, some of them, where we were going. And we talked for a while. Some ideas, at least one to explore and understand. And then I think I talked to Rod Hills about it. Rod had known me. And back up, because it fits with Sandy. Almost wherever I've been, I've always tried to have someone or several people whose role it was to kind of be an independent critic. Because it can be offensive for all of us to just barrel ahead, and that's part of why I tried to have these retreats too. And I've done that in the industry. In fact, the person who did it with the industry was still a lifelong friend.
In fact, there's been some suggestions that one director on every board should be designated for a period of 6 months or a year as
the pain in the ass. Well, you did a lot of that. And Ralph did too, but in the market area, I had a sense that Sandy could do a lot of that for me in an area that was, I knew was going to be controversial and important, that he had a lot of background experience in the markets, and at least I wanted to hear what he had to say.
My recollection is that the market rec staff was less than totally happy about
it. Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Which perhaps was a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, other than that, in terms of personalities,
there was turnover in some of the leadership of the division in terms of bringing in people from the outside.
Yeah.
Did you feel that was important at the commission?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a double-edged sword in the sense I really respect
the continuity. And we're losing a lot of that. It's the continuity of people like a Nurt Pollock who sort of had a history that one could draw on that was useful. And then on the downside, things can become too incestuous and too insular, and you can respect the past more than one should. And so I was really interested in finding a balance there and really trying to do some ventilating. And that's when Ed came in, and Mike Connell, and I think Bob Posen came in, didn't he? And I don't remember anybody else.
Jeff Schenkel.
Yeah, Marty Leibecker.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think there's got to be a balance. In fact, what worries me now, as I'm repeating myself, is that we don't have the degree of continuity that I think would be a plus.
Well, do you think it's positive for one or more of the commissioners to have come up from the staff?
Yeah, I do. Provided they can kind of separate themselves, they're no longer a staff member. It's a real plus.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. And Annette Nazareth is the first person in a while.
Right. No, I think that's a plus.
Well, we began with the election of Jimmy Carter. I guess we have to begin to end with the election of Ronald Reagan. Had you known John Shadd before? Or did you have any contact? Did you meet with him and give him advice? Or
I met him when he first came aboard. It was just a social meeting. I had two conversations with him after that. The first one related to who should be his general counsel. And I had a recommendation for him, which he listened to. The second one...
Oh, thank you.
The second one was sort of a, how am I doing? And I said, John, you've taken the top off the beat. That's the last I heard from John Shadd.
After you left the commission, you ended up at the Getty Foundation. How did that come about?
Well, it Christmas time of 1980, I was sitting at home and waiting to be elected. I knew I wouldn't be this pleasure.
Had you known him in California at all?
I knew of him. I'd never met him, but I knew his staff coming in. In fact, I was a TA at a county at UCLA when Bob Haldeman was in the class. Yeah, in fact, I ended up teaching the course because the professor took him. I knew it wouldn't be that, you know, he served the pleasure of the president, and Mr. Reagan would have a different pleasure. But I thought I'd rather set my own timing than wait for him to tell me that. Because I could have stayed on as commissioner, but I really had no interest in doing this. So I wrote him a letter saying I would leave effective February 28th. And then I didn't know, now what do I do? Well, two things came along. One thing came along, actually, that is, people, Paul Weiss contacted me with the idea of Jerry Kurtz, who had been the commissioner who turned in the service, and I would open the Washington office. And I was in conversation with him. It was interesting. I wasn't sure if that would be what I wanted to do. And in the meantime, I called some friends of mine who had led the kind of varied life that died right up to that time. There was John Gardner, Franklin Murphy on the West Coast, and neither of them had any immediate, John and Norm Cousins. Neither of them had immediate idea, but they thought they might come up with something. Well, Franklin's out in Los Angeles. He was then chairman of Times Mirror. He'd been president of the University of Kansas, or chancellor of UCLA, and I was at Times Mirror. But he got a call from the Getty Trust, and Mr. Getty had died. The trustees were retainers of his, so they weren't very outstanding people, but simply. And Mr. Getty's estate was about to close, but they didn't know what to do from there. So they were calling other people. They called Derek Bach, they called Franklin, some others, saying, hey, do you have any ideas about who might be the right person? Franklin said, well, I've got the perfect person for you. And that's how it came to
to be. And the interesting thing about it is I went out and visited with them, and on February 28th, I guess it was some kind of an SEC event that day. I don't know what it was. I think I gave a talk that day. Because the SEC speaks on things.
It could have been. It's usually the end of February, yeah, beginning of March. Okay.
But there was an event that day. It was my last day as a commissioner. I got home, I didn't have a job to go to. I thought, this is going to be interesting. First time in my life, I've been out of a job, no place to go. But the phone rang, and it was the chair of the Getty, and they offered me the position. And it was a whole new challenge for me, an interesting one, to sort of almost a clean slate to create something with. But that really intrigued me. Plus, it was in Los Angeles, and my kids were there. It was going home.
Well, you really, in a sense, switch careers again.
Yeah.
Did you have much contact then after you left and went to Getty with the people you had worked with or come to know through your chairmanship at the SEC?
Very limited.
Yeah. You've been sort of a capstone of the securities regulation and then left that world completely for something totally different.
Yeah.
Have you, I guess John Shan aside, have subsequent chairman of the SEC called you for advice or talked to you about what
they're doing? Arson Levitt did a few times. He was the only one who did. And, you know, Chris Cox just had the Ronald Lynch chairman back. I participated in that. I don't know whether there will be any further contact with Cox. But, you know, that's a pattern, whether it's private sector, nonprofit, you name it. There's a tendency for people coming into leadership positions not to talk to their predecessors. And, I don't know what that's about. I had another conversation with Rod Hills. We disagreed on a lot of things, but it was a valuable perspective to have. And I pretty respected Rod's mind. But I'm not surprised that I didn't have much contact with him.
How about you switch back, in a sense, somewhat to the leaving Getty and going to Skadden after all these years and coming back, in a sense, to securities regulation? How did you find that?
Well, I had no intention to go back to the practice of law. I had announced to the staff and the public at Getty that once we opened the Getty Center, I was going to leave. I've been there 17 years. And I've accomplished everything I came to do. I'm a creator. I manage as a means towards an end. I don't like to manage as an end in itself. And I couldn't see myself staying on. The day after it hit the press, I got a call from the senior people at Skadden. They came to visit me. I said, I'm not going to have any thought about doing it. But I knew the people at the LA office of Skadden because I've been on a number of independent committees on boards, and when I had any influence on it, I invited them in because I like the way they practice law and their competence. What I like about that office particularly, and I can't say this for all law offices, is my expression is they're not dragon slayers. They don't magnify the problem you've got so they can come in and slay it. They're pretty straight describing, you know, what's your problem, what can we do about it, what do we know? Which I really respect a lot. And after thinking about it, I said, it could be interesting. I could be a resource. One thing I've got to say, I'm not going to be a rainmaker. I'm not going to go out and dream up business. That's what you want to forget. I said, either one of us could cut it off at a day's notice. And it's been fun. I'm called on for advice and opinion. I get involved in individual matters occasionally, directly. I can do some coaching of younger lawyers and associates. And my management experience, as well as my management experience, I probably spend a fair amount of my time on management types of issues, where the management partners are delighted to, we haven't had much of a management partner, delighted to have today to help out in some respect. So it's been fun, but it's part time.
And in the meantime, we've moved our home up into the San Ynez Valley, and so that's kind of fun too.
Any last words of advice for the current commission?
No, okay. I like what Cox and the commission has done on compensation. That was overdue. I'm delighted to be doing it. As I told the chairman, with both Sarbanes and Oxley leaving the Hill, I hope there's no effort to, I hope that the commission would resist any effort to water down Sarbanes-Oxley. I think it still has enough momentum that that's not likely to happen, but something to guard against.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'll think about that one.
Thank you.
And thank you very much.